Good morning, everybody. Would you get your Bibles, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4. If you're going to use one of the Bibles that are underneath the chair, it's on page 932. And when you get there, you're going to see 1 Corinthians 13, 4 saying, love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. This week we're going to continue in our study of 1 Corinthians 13 in a series called A Love Worth Living. I've recently read where this chapter is often described as this portrait of love. And when you dig down into it a little bit, you can't help notice that in giving a portrait of love, the Apostle Paul is actually given us a portrait of Jesus Christ, because he is love. I came across this line: Christ would like to reproduce his portrait in us and to have his church as a collection of reprints. I kind of like that. The author was saying, as we are studying the qualities of love in 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7, and examining the portrait of Christ revealed therein, Christ is looking at us to see if his portrait is being reprinted and reproduced in us. So I ask, is it? Is it happening in you and me and us? Are we, even now, as a church, growing more Christ-like? Man, I hope so. If we are within God's will, it ought to be happening. But how can we know? How can we be certain that we're growing in Christ's likeness? The answer is by the very same way that the world will know that we are his, by our love for one another. Jesus declared it very clearly in John 13, verses 34 to 35. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples, if you love one another. Jesus commanded, as I have loved you, so you must love one another. So the question can quickly become, what does his love look like? How does Christ-like love behave? And that's the point where the Apostle Paul starts. When we open up 1 Corinthians 13 before us, we see that Paul doesn't get all caught up in defining love per se. Instead, he attempts to describe how love acts, as opposed to what we often see around us or even in us. Basically, when we step back and look at 1 Corinthians 13 and its larger context of the whole book of 1 Corinthians and the problems that the church there in Corinth were having, the fighting among themselves and all the problems they were having, what Paul is saying is this: love is very patient, but we're mostly impatient. Love is very kind, but we're frequently unkind. Love wants the best for others, but we often envy and want what they have. And today, love makes no parade. It doesn't toot its own horn and say, hey, look at me. But we can be quick to boast, and we tend to puff up when we do. This week, we're looking at 1 Corinthians 13, 4. Love does not boast, it is not proud. Look at the screen, would you? The Phillips translation has it as, it is neither anxious to impress, nor does it cherish inflated ideas of its own importance. The American Standard Version takes its cue from the King James and says, love vaunteth not itself. Love doesn't project itself up on a big screen for everybody to look at, you know? It's not puffed up. The New American Standard Bible says, love does not brag, and it's not arrogant. And my most favorite of all, the Message says, love doesn't strut, doesn't have a swelled head. I honestly think the Apostle Paul would look at that last one, and he'd say, amen, that's what I'm talking about. But can we be honest? In our culture, we've kind of made strutting an art form, haven't we? In case you didn't know it, there's a game on today, you know. If you watch the players or the fans before, during, or after the game, it's all, hey, look at me. It's all about strutting. That's why I've named this sermon, Love Doesn't Go Bling Bling. You know what I'm talking about? Let me give you a short history of bling, all right? Now, the expression bling or bling bling is a relatively modern or recent word. And it wasn't until 2003 that the phrase was recognized by the Oxford English Dictionary and officially inducted into their lexicon. As many of you know, this expression started out in the hip-hop community, but quickly became adopted across the board. It started off referring solely to diamonds and jewelries and watches and these chains and everything, but soon it became synonymous with exotic cars and planes and really whatever else you could parade before people and say, hey, look at me. Now, bling might be a relatively new word, having only made its appearance within the last 20 years or so, but it's an old idea, isn't it? After all, there was a time when the entire known world was all abuzz about Solomon's splendor. And about that same time, well, Cleopatra wasn't exactly known to be bashful. And soon thereafter, the Roman Empire did everything in its power to say, look at me. And when we look at one short generation ago, Elizabeth Taylor made sure that everybody got a picture of it. Remember the Richard Burton ring? Liberace flaunted it. Elvis made sure he sparkled in Las Vegas. Elton John might have leaned a little bit towards the flamboyant. You know, it's not a new idea. It's just that we've seemed to refine it a little bit more lately. In November of 2003, the same year that bling officially became a word in our dictionary, there was a published article called It's All About the Bling Bling, and Virginia Rohan reported that the Hollywood film studio Warner Brothers has launched a luxury range of clothes, get this, not for film stars, but for pampered pooches. This is serious, all right? The collection, inspired by Scooby-Doo, the cowardly cartoon dog, boasted some of the most expensive canine accoutrements in the world. It was launched at a canine fashion show in London and included a $2,500 satin dog coat studded with Swarovski crystals and lined in pink silk, and a diamond-encrusted platinum dog collar pendant embossed with the initials SD, Scooby-Doo, costing over $21,000 for a pooch. There were also crystal-studded collars and leads at $1,200 a set, dog bowls, $675, travel cases for your dog, travel cases with brushes, nail clippers, and flea powder, can't forget the flea powder, for over $1,000. I'm not making this up. And unisex pillows and beds, blue on one side, pink on the other, for $250 for dogs. The cheapest item was an $85 bandana that could be turned into a, I quote, a doggy headscarf should the weather turn stormy. $85, dog, you're going to get wet, you know. Anyway, a spokesman for Warner Brothers said, we noticed that there's a trend for dogs and dog products in the media, and so we want to get our products into the shops. Sales of pet accessories are phenomenal. It's a $4 billion business still. Sales of pet accessories are phenomenal. A lot of people are delaying having children and spending money on their dogs and cats instead. Let's see. Should I bring a child into this world or get a diamond-encrusted platinum dog collar for my pooch? I don't know. Now, this was a 2003 article, and try as I might, I can't seem to find any reference to a current clothing line of doggy extravagance still being available today. So evidently, the American public wasn't quite as gullible as they once were counting on. Aren't you glad that we got that out of our system? Not so fast, Grasshopper. All right, I'm referring to a December 10th, 2019 article by Lisa Johnson Mandel, just a little over a month ago. The article was named, "Here's What a $70,000 Doghouse Looks Like, Prepare to Drool." All right, I quote, "Need a really swanky holiday gift for a special hound in your life? Then consider a new doghouse for $70,000. This lavish purchase for your pooch is on sale in the recently released Neiman Marcus Christmas book, a much heralded annual compendium of extravagant fantasy gifts for the rich and famous. The book includes everything from a Versace punching bag, $1,550, to a Monet and Chandon champagne vending machine, $35,000. Everybody's got a Coke machine. How gauche, you know, mine does champagne. They do. But the gifts that really caught our eye this year were the custom dog mansions, I'm quoting, created by celebrity designer Jessica Clark with input from actress and animal activist Denise Richards. Prices start at $70,000 and shoot skyward from there, depending on just how lavish your dog tastes take you. What you're looking at on the screen right now is referred to as the reflection mirrored doghouse. I guess your dog goes in and jumps on that leather couch and reflects on what it's like to be a dog. I don't know, right? You can choose different styles like this doggy bank vault. That makes a statement, don't you think? Or maybe this Taj Mahal doghouse is your style. There's a note in the article that reads, "Building materials depend on whether this doghouse is for indoor or outdoor use. This one is made of architectural foam and stucco." My dog would consider that a $70,000 chew toy, all right? 24 hours, there would be foam all over the backyard. Serious question. Why would you? The only reason could be that I not only want my house to be bigger and nicer and more expensive than your house, I want my dog's house to be nicer than your house too. C.S. Lewis once said, "Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man." I don't think we've gotten on the other side of this yet, folks. Vogue magazine proclaimed last year, 2019, as the year of bling, mostly because of red carpet events like the Oscars, where Lady Gaga wore a Tiffany necklace centered by a 128.54 carat yellow diamond masterpiece with 82 facets. Look at that thing she's wearing. That's not a rock. It's a boulder. You know, it's huge. Nobody ever notices, but there are 60 other honking big diamonds in that necklace, and it's all set in a platinum setting. You know, I bet both Solomon and Cleopatra would have looked twice. 2019 is also the year that Jennifer Lopez won a collection of gems worth over $8.8 million at one time to another red carpet event. Psalm 63:6 says that there are those who wear their pride like a necklace. Can you say bling? Can you say major bling? All right. Now, I don't believe we have a $70,000 doghouse stuck behind someone's home in our community. I just don't believe that. But I bet we have some pretty nice sheds and outbuildings for our toys. And speaking of our toys, we like our toys, don't we? Whether they have two wheels or four wheels or more wheels. Or whether we load them with a clip or we just load up on whatever we like. we like our toys, don't we? And while I haven't seen anybody walking down the street looking like Lady Gaga, we do like our boots and our hats and certain shoes and things that people notice. And there are still bigger houses and bigger barns and bigger trucks and bigger still counts even in our community, doesn't it? But if the Apostle Paul was here this morning, he'd be sure to tell you that love doesn't go bling bling. It doesn't even bling, you know? Because according to 1 Corinthians 13:4, love does not boast. It is not proud. Let's get serious now. That first statement, love does not boast, it represents like the verbalizing of pride, the actual speech or action of pride. The second, love is not proud, represents the attitude of pride. It's the conceit that's down inside that fuels the boasting. In fact, the meaning of the word that is translated, love does not boast, comes from a root word that means windbag. You can picture it, can't you? One commentator says that it suggests self-centered actions in which there's an inordinate desire to call attention to oneself. Think of what we've been looking at this morning. Have we ever seen anything like that? Yeah. Another person said this refers to a parading of one's accomplishments. It can be seen as the other side of envy and jealousy, for it involves attempting to make others envious of what we have. And while jealousy seeks to put others down, bragging is an attempt to lift our own selves up. Several years ago, at the Galveston County Fair and Rodeo, a steer named Husker weighed in at almost 1,200 pounds and was named Grand Champion. The steer was sold at an auction for a huge sum and slaughtered a few days after the competition. I guess Husker is what we could call cowboy bling. But anyway, when the veterinarians examined the carcass, they found something suspicious. They discovered evidence of what is called airing. There are those of you in this room who know what I'm talking about. To give steers a better appearance, competitors have been known to inject air into their animals' hides with a syringe or a needle attached to a bicycle pump. Pump long enough, and they got themselves what looks to be like a grand champion steer, though, of course, it's against the rules, end of quote. Paul says love does not boast. It's not a windbag. It's not full of hot air. Love doesn't shoot its mouth all out, you know, just talk about its own accomplishments. It doesn't puff itself up to look better. Love does not speak this arrogant chatter that's made or designed to make me look better than you. And that brings us to pride. Pride has often been defined as an exaggerated and dishonest self-evaluation. This is one of my favorite cartoons, all right? It's a representation of myself that I want other people to accept in spite of my own awareness that it's a false and inflated image. Pride seeks value and honor and importance and its significance and reputation that it does not deserve. And just like envy last week, it is an enemy of love. Remember what Paul said last week? Love does not envy. Envy is wanting something other people have. And bragging is making people want what you have. And pride, man, it gets all mixed up in there somewhere, and they're hard to sort out at times, except it's wrong. Except when it's happening, you can tell it's not love. Unless it's self-love. Because Christ-like love, it heals and it lifts others up. Boasting and pride divides and puts others down by lifting self up, even if it's not true. When it comes to your relationships with others, pride hurts and it can ruin relationships. Speaking again of pride, C.S. Lewis wrote, "There is no fault that makes a man more unpopular. It's the one vice that everyone loathes when they see it. The problem is that when we're proud and we brag, we produce the exact opposite of what we're trying to accomplish. In pride, we think, man, when I tell them this, it's really going to impress them. It's really going to wow everyone with this one, you know? Well, you might get the wow reaction, but it's likely to be, wow, what a jerk, you know? That's what often happens, right? Let's be real. We just recently went through a significant holiday season, right? Lots of family gatherings. Doesn't it seem like there's at least one person in every family who knows all, seen all, did all, or at least everything that's worthwhile to do, know, or see, that's according to the things, and they never really listen to anybody else because they already know all the answers. This person's already been to the nicest vacation spot, seen the best movie, read the best book, have a better car, kids, house, job, whatever. And their favorite line is, well, if you think that's something, no names. But does everybody got somebody like that in mind? Here's a hint. If you can't think of anybody, you might be that someone. Watch it, because love never brags or blows its own horn. It is not proud. In fact, Proverbs 13:10 says, pride only breeds quarrels. Man, this is so true. It's true in my home. It's really true in my home. It's true in a workplace. It's true here at church. Pride just starts trouble again and again. But humility has never started a fight yet. The worst thing humility is going to do is we're going to get two people stuck at the front door saying, after you, no, after you, no, please, after you. You know, that's not going to make the evening news. But pride only breeds quarrels. It spawns trouble. It's the natural result of its presence in a relationship. The King James Version has, only by pride cometh contention. If you read the footnote, it says, you wanteth, troubleth, prideth is your answereth, you know. Or as Galatians 5:26 rightly notes, let us not become conceited, provoking, and envying each other. According to a story in the Grand Rapids Press, the owner of a small foreign car had begun to irritate his friends by bragging incessantly about his gas mileage. So they decided on a way to try to get some humor out of this never-ending boasting, as well as to try to bring it to an end. Every day, one of them would sneak into the parking lot where the man kept his car and pour a few gallons of gas in his tank. Soon, the braggart was recording absolutely phenomenal mileage. He was boasting of getting as much as 90 miles per gallon. And the pranksters who were all around him, they had this secret delight in his frustration as the guy tried to convince people the truthfulness of his claims. No, really, I'm getting this. I can prove it. You know, he's keeping his mileage in on that. And the article said it was even more fun to watch his reaction when they stopped refilling his tank. The poor fellow couldn't figure out what happened to his car, you know. Let us not become conceited, provoking, and envying each other. You might say, oh, man, that's not right. Shouldn't prank somebody like that. Maybe not. But I can guarantee you that God thinks even less of pride and boasting than we do. Proverbs 8:13, God declares, I hate pride and arrogance. 1 Peter 5:5, we read, God opposes the proud. That's a strong word. Why is God opposed to the proud? One more time, C.S. Lewis has written, when you come up against God, you come up against someone who is in every respect immeasurably superior to yourself. Unless you know God as that, and know yourself as nothing in comparison, you can't know God at all. As long as you are proud, you can't know God. The proud man is always looking down on people. And of course, when you look down, you can't see someone who's above you. Here's something else to think about in regarding pride and relationships. At the very least, pride postpones or delays reconciliation. If people are proud, it not only distances us from others, it not only causes quarrels, it not only messes us up with God, but if a person is caught up in pride, then they aren't willing to back down or compromise or find a common ground where agreement can be found. So reconciliation simply doesn't take place. A preacher by the name of Cliff Barrels says that there are 12 words that are absolutely essential for a good marriage or relationship of any kind. Here they are, four sets of three. I bet you've seen them before. I was wrong. I was sorry. Please forgive me. I love you. Any relationship, he says, has to have these 12 words in it or it simply won't work. If you have a husband who is so proud that he will never say, I was wrong. If you have a wife who is so proud that she will never say, I'm sorry. If you have children who are so proud that they will never say, please forgive me. Then you got a family where no one is saying, I love you to each other. And that relationship simply can't work. In any relationship, if we aren't willing to say, I'm wrong, or I'm sorry, or please forgive me, or admit we love each other, then reconciliation can never take place. And I wonder how many relationships remain broken to this day simply because of pride. In a congregation of our size, there are undoubtedly some folks who are estranged from others because someone's pride makes someone unwilling to admit fault or confess blame, to forgive or to reconcile. Perhaps it's a family member or a neighbor, a co-worker, or someone who is seated within eyesight of you right now. Is your pride keeping you from reconciliation? No wonder Paul says love does not boast, it is not proud. Because if God is about anything, it's about reconciliation, isn't he? That's why Christ came. He humbled himself, even to a cross, to reach out in love, to make things right. So Paul says this is the most excellent way. This is a love worth living. How do we overcome it? How do we overcome this boasting and pride thing? Got your outlines? Write down a few words, would you please? The first step may be having a sane estimate of your life. Romans 12:3 says, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought. The Phillips translation of that same verse says, don't cherish exaggerated ideas of yourself or your importance, but try to have a sane estimate of your capabilities. Now, before going on, I mean, seriously, do you realize how rare that is in any circle of people? In April of 2014, an article by Martha Dusterhoff was published that read, in our world of selfies and social media apps to facilitate telling the world about our every thought and how we spend our time, it's not shocking that humility is a characteristic often in short supply. She wrote, I recently read that the College Board, the organization that administers the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SATs, taken by millions of high school students each year, shows evidence of an overinflated opinion of ourselves. Shocking. On the SAT test, there are a number of questions other than math and English which the students are asked to answer. For example, they are asked to evaluate their leadership ability where, catch this, 70% of the students rated themselves as above average in leadership and only 2% as below average. When it comes to athletics, 60% rated themselves as above average, while only 6% rated below average. Must have been a really good crop of kids that year, right? Listen to this. In rating in how easy they are to get along with, 25% of all the kids, millions of kids, 25% said they were in the top 1%. 60% said they were in the top 10%. And here it is. And absolutely no one said they were below average and being easy to get along with. How about that? We have rooms of thousands and thousands of teenagers spread all across their nation, and not one of them is difficult in nature or hard to get along with. She concludes, let's be clear, this isn't necessarily a generational issue. She says, I've worked with a number of executives in my range and older who think that they're all of that and a bag of chips, if you know what I mean. End of quote. I think we can agree there's an issue here, and it's not just with our kids. I attended a preaching summit several years ago in Indianapolis. At one point, Bob Russell, who was the longtime preacher at Southeast Christian Church in Louisville, Kentucky, he asked the assembled crowd to grade themselves from 1 being terrible to 10 being terrific on our own personal preaching skills. He gave us a little time, and then he asked all of those who had scored themselves a 5 or below, average to below average, to raise their hands. Now you got to get the picture. We're in this ballroom, and there's somewhere over 500 preachers in that room, and not 5 people raised their hands. That means out of 500 preachers, we had about 495 above average preachers assembled. Seemingly everybody in the room was an above average preacher. Do you believe that? I don't either. You'll recall that one description of pride is an exaggerated and dishonest self-evaluation where you're promoting something about yourself that simply isn't true. We may have a problem. So what does it mean to have a sane estimate of your life? The answer is that you see yourself as God sees you. You see yourself in relation to God. Realize who He is: infinite, holy, perfect, all-knowing, all-powerful, just to name a few. How do you stack up against God? John Calvin was the father of the Reformed and Presbyterian tradition. His life motto was this: always in the presence of God. That thought helped him maintain the sane estimate of himself, and it also kept him humble, even grateful. Jonathan Edwards provides some needed insight on humility. He wrote, pride is something that God forbids, but God does not do that because He's worried about His dignity. His concern is for your dignity. He continued that humility is an excellence proper to all intelligent beings, for they know they are infinitely little before God. What's he saying here? Humility is a mark of intelligence. Or as Proverbs 11:2 says, when pride comes, then comes disgrace, but with humility comes wisdom. To not be humble, to not recognize who you are before God, is not very intelligent, and it's more than just a little bit short-sighted. But that's what happens when, because of pride, you can't see beyond yourself, isn't it? Second way to prevent pride is to recognize God's grace. Write that in. It's a good word. A second way to prevent pride is to recognize God's grace, to affirm that all you have is a gift from God. We get caught up in these cycles where we say, you know, I earned that money and I did the work to get that award and that degree, that scholarship, that promotion. Who gave you your mind, your body, your abilities, gifts, and skills? Who gave you your intelligence, your hands, your life? If it was Mother's Day, I'd say the prudent answer is Mom, all right? The bigger picture is God himself. People, it's all a gift. Listen to this verse, Psalms 10:4. In his pride, the wicked man does not seek him. In all of his thoughts, there is no room for God. That's kind of scary, isn't it? He's so full of himself that there's no room for God. Did you choose where you were born, your parents, your natural gifts and abilities? No. The fact is that God allowed all these things to happen to you. The fact is that everything you have, you owe to God. James chapter 1, verse 17 says, every good and perfect gift comes from God. Everything you have is a gift from his hand. 1 Corinthians 1:31, therefore, as it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. A third way to battle pride is to give, it's to give some of that gift that we get from him back. Serve, right in that word, would you please? Jesus said of himself, and remember who he is and where he came from, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Matthew 20, verse 28. To be real straight with you, it's hard for me to understand how people can be Christians for almost any length of time and still be a servee and not a server. Think about it. How can we claim that we're followers of the one who put a towel around his waist and picked up a basin of water and washed his apostles' feet? How can we say that we're his follower and we're still waiting to be served? That's our expectation, that first my needs need to be met, that things need to be done to my taste and my preference. How can we do that? See, the only way that we can finally begin to develop the virtue of humility is by becoming a servant, by learning servanthood. A great way to fight pride is to serve. It's a great way to love, too. Fourth way to prevent pride is to experience and embrace God's love. Write it down. And that's really where we have to start this whole thing anyway. I read about a guy who, for a summer job, he worked on a pile-driving crew building highway bridges in the Washington, D.C. area. You ever been one of the huge pile drivers that sinks the beams down to serve as a foundation for large buildings or bridges? I can remember when they were building a new baseball stadium in downtown St. Louis. They built the new stadium right next to where Interstate 64 crosses the Mississippi River from Illinois and into Missouri. They built it so close that from the right-hand lane of the interstate, you could literally soft toss something from the car and it would hit the stadium. And when they were sinking those pilings, the physical roadway and the bridge would shake. I'm not talking about vibrate. It would shake. Bing, bing, bing. Each one. It would vibrate like that. It got your attention. But this man writes that undoubtedly the loudest and scariest sound we had to put up with in building the bridges were not the pile drivers. It was the noise of the empty trucks as they went over the bridge. Full trucks weren't as noisy. The empty trucks just rattled and bounced and vibrated, making a racket all along the way. And he says, that's a good picture of the proud person. Pride is not only a sin that God opposes, but it also indicates an emptiness in here. The proud, vain person is empty inside. It's a void that doesn't look or feel good, so he puts up this false front, boasting and promoting himself as someone that he's not, desperately trying to win acceptance and affirmation, and it just doesn't work. Is there an alternative? Absolutely. It's called God's love. And it'll fill that emptiness, that void in your life. Look at the screen, would you please? Ephesians 3, beginning with verse 18, Paul writes, I pray that you, he's talking to the church, to Christ's followers, I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power together with all of the saints to grasp, to begin to comprehend, to begin to own how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge. Then look what he says about this void in your life. That you may be purpose filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. That's what God's love for you in Jesus Christ can do. It can fill the void. When you experience and embrace God's love, you're set free from pride's constant yearning for affirmation and recognition and praise from other people. You're liberated from self-promotion, from the desperation that comes when you feel like you need to validate your worth in front of other people. Why? Because He's declared, I love you. You don't need to prove yourself to me. You don't need to validate your worth before me. You don't need to win my acceptance. I already love you. This is the most amazing truth in all the world to me, that God knows every single detail of my life, every thought, word, and action. And in spite of that, certainly not because of it, but in spite of it, he loves me. My performance does not dictate the level or intensity of his love. He already loves me with what Scripture repeatedly calls an unending and unfailing love. That's good news, folks. That's good news. That's something to stand on. I'm going to close by asking you to consider one of the smartest things you could ever do. Reject pride. Stop living in pride and all the wreckage it generates, because that's what it is. Last verse today, Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit, that's pride, and a haughty spirit, one that looks down on others, before a fall. I guarantee you, I don't care who you are, I guarantee you that's not your preferred life's destination. Pride, a building up of self, leading to destruction, leading to a fall. And God has something infinitely better for you. The redeeming love he has for you in Jesus Christ. The love that can transform your life, your relationship with God, your relationship with your spouse, your children. It can and it will, if you choose it, transform your relationship with your friends and co-workers and the very people who are seated within eyesight of you. That supernatural love can change your life today and can change it forever. That's the love in which the great, the good, the gracious God declares, I love you, period. I love you. It's a love he not only wants to share with us, but biblically it says he wants to pour it into us. It's a love worth living. That's it. That's all I got. I can't tell you how many hours I've got into the sermon, how much reading, and I had 45 minutes and nothing left. You know, that's kind of sad, isn't it? All that time, and that's as far as I can go. Let's lighten it up for just a hair, okay? There's a game on today. I'm rooting for the Chiefs because I got a buddy named Kenny, all right? Big question all week is, who's going to win, right? Anyway, big question all week is, who's going to win? And I can say, I want the Chiefs to win, but I'm afraid the Niners are going to win. So at the end of the day, I can say, I told you so, you know? And that's what we call wisdom. Seriously, think about it. Nobody knows. One knows. Nobody else. I can sit before you. I've loved football for a long time. I got a bunch of football helmets in my office. I got all these NFL shirts. I played for, not NFL, but I played football for about that long, you know. I can sit here and we could talk about, you know, the way that this game's going to come down to is, well, the Niners, man, they own both lines. They got defense. Defense wins these kind of games, you know. But the Chiefs now, they got this team speed, and it won't matter because the Niners can't man up on them, and they got the speed to run through the zones. They got Mahomes, you know. And they don't know. And neither does anybody else. We can act like it. We can puff ourselves up. But we don't know. There is one who knows. And he's a lot, I'm not being smart here, he's a lot more worried about you than he is a game. And he proved it because of Jesus going to a cross. Every one of us in this room has this void. We can pretend like we're all that and a bag of chips, like that lady said, you know. We can act like it. We can walk. We even know how to strut, you know. But the truth is, we've got this emptiness. We've got this hole. We've got this void that we can't fill ourselves. And Jesus came with a love that stretches all the way from heaven to the cross to fill that void and to be for you what we can never be for ourselves. What are we going to stand on? Who are we going to promote? Where are we going to turn? I suggest that we embrace this gift that we've been given called the love of God in such a way that we not only receive it, but we want to share it with others. Amen. Let's stand and sing. Ask the prayer partners to come forward. We've got a prayer area in the back.